afternoon. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 1994. We're multicasting live from our studios in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Today's guest is Governor John Engler of Michigan. Engler, a Republican, will be speaking on the subject of welfare reform at work, Michigan success story. The head table has sat down and is in the process of trying to make a dignified staff at eating lunch in front of a large room full of people. Gil Klein, sitting right next to the podium, he's a national correspondent for Media General News Service, and this is Klein's first luncheon as a newly elected president of the National Press Club. While we're waiting for the luncheon to begin, we'll turn the microphone over to our house band, Tungsten Macaque. This is the Internet Multicasting Service, Flame of the Internet.
exactly am. Here. Don't worry about it. Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I am president of the club and a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome you all here in the ballroom today, as well as those of you who are watching this on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind you of some upcoming speakers. On Friday, February 4th, which is tomorrow, House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt will talk about the health care reform bill. On Tuesday, February 8th, Randall Terry, Executive Director of Operation Rescue, will talk about the Republican Party, enemy of a Christian nation. No offense, Governor. And on Tuesday, February 15th, Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary will talk about the Cold War is over, we want your trust, and we'll work to earn it. Transcripts of audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available at the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for a speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them at the cards provided for you at the tables and pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all names are read. From your right is Lisa Zagarelli, did I get that right? Good, of the Associated Press. Karen Grasmick of Thompson Newspapers. George Embry of the Columbus Dispatch. Lori Montgomery of the Detroit Free Press. Larry Bivens of the Detroit News. John Truscott, Press Secretary to Governor Engler. Skipping over our speaker for a second, we have freelance journalist Christy Wise, who is the chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee this year. Jerry Miller, Director of Social Services for the State of Michigan. Richard Ryan of the Detroit News and the member of our committee who organized today's luncheon. Susan Feeney of the Dallas Morning News. Sarah Kellogg of Newhouse Newspapers, and Jerry Moskal of the Gannett News Service. Now you can applaud. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsbury, Melanie Abdow, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, our speaker today is John Engler, the Republican governor of Michigan. Now, when Speakers Committee Chairwoman Christy Wise and I were talking about who are we going to invite to speak, I said, let's get the governor of Michigan. He's really stirred things up there by signing a bill that eliminated the property tax as a means of financing education. And now he has come up, and now he has to come up with a way to make up for a $6 billion shortfall. We need to have somebody to talk about that. So we extended the invitation. He accepted, except that his speech today is about welfare reform, because he's really stirred things up in Michigan by dropping 83,000 single able-bodied people from the state's general assistance welfare. This is obviously a guy who likes to stir things up. As an agricultural student back in Michigan State University, Mr. Engler wrote a term paper, not what you would expect on agricultural price supports or methods of irrigation. His term paper was on how to defeat an incumbent office holder. 6 months later, he did just that, winning an election to the state house as the youngest member in Michigan's history. 8 years later, he defeated another incumbent to win a state senate seat, and 3 years ago, at the age of 42, he was elected Michigan's governor. Welfare reform is one of those hot topics in this town right now. Along with health care and crime, it will be the leading issue in this year's Congress. In his State of the Union message, President Clinton promised Congress last week a welfare reform proposal that will make welfare a second chance and not a way of life. Mr. Engler might give him a few pointers. He has taken the lead on welfare reform among the nation's governors, and he has come up with a welfare plan for Michigan that he claims really works. Like Clinton, Mr. Engler wants to make welfare a temporary safety net. He wants to limit welfare checks to 2 years, encourage welfare recipients to work by allowing them to keep more of their earned income, and get tough on deadbeat dads who refuse to pay child support. The governor is here today to tell us more about what he wants to do about welfare reform. And to tell you the truth, I'm probably going to ask him a few questions about what he's going to do about this education problem. But perhaps if President Clinton doesn't get a welfare reform proposal through Congress, Mr. Engler will just dust off that old term paper and see what he can do for himself. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome to Mr. John Engler.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Gil Klein. I understand that this is your first meeting presiding as president of the National Press Club, and given that introduction, there are some interesting meetings that lie ahead, so thank you very much. And it is an honor for me to join all of you today and to be present at the National Press Club to talk about welfare reform. I'm delighted to note in the audience the president of my congressman, Congressman David Camp. Welcome, Congressman. And I'm delighted that there's so many other opinion makers from across the nation's capital that are present today. This is a town where everyone has an opinion about everything. I've noted that on my trips here. In fact, on the drive downtown from the airport, the taxi driver told me that he knew all there was to know about welfare reform. He said there are two ways to get it done in Washington, the easy way and the hard way. So I asked him, well, what's the easy way? He said, well, the easy way would be for God and his angels to come down from the heavens and just make it happen. So I'm afraid to ask, what's the hard way? He said, well, the hard way would be for Congress to pass both health care and welfare reform in the same year. Now, it may explain why this morning there was a record crowd over at the prayer breakfast. I am here because during 1992, the presidential election campaign, throughout last year, and again in the State of the Union message, President Clinton promised to end welfare as we know it. America's governors are ready to help. America's frustrated and angry taxpayers are ready to have it happen now. They want action. And that means that the president must do more than talk about reform. He must be willing to fight for it. Republican and Democrat governors speak with one voice on this issue. We believe it is possible to end welfare as we know it. And we told the president this week we're ready to fight together with him for change and reform. To his credit, President Clinton has continued the policy of granting waivers that the states need to implement welfare reform. 9 waivers so far in the first year. But reform, one waiver at a time, won't get the job done. States should not have to trek to Washington every time we seek to reform a broken system. So let me describe the ideal national welfare reform plan. Turn the status quo upside down. Free the states to implement the changes they want. It's that simple. Just do it. Senator Moynihan talked about it at the National Governors Association meeting earlier this week. He said, we'll learn what to do from the states. You teach us, we'll pass the bill. I agree. Congress should pass the bill and stop passing the buck. The ideas, the excitement, the enthusiasm for reform are in the states, like Wisconsin, Delaware, Massachusetts, and especially Michigan, where welfare reform means work, and our reforms are working. If reform means more personal responsibility, we're doing it in Michigan. If reform means parents supporting their children, we're doing it in Michigan. If reform means keeping families together, we're doing it in Michigan. And if reform means more working families, again, we're doing it in Michigan. In fact, work is the key to building strong families, and that's our goal in Michigan, more strong families. Our welfare reform plan is called to strengthen Michigan families. Everyone has a copy of the plan today at their table and concludes our 1994 agenda. We're strengthening families all across the state because our reforms are being implemented statewide. They're not limited pilot programs. And today what I'd like to do is give you a brief look at what we've already accomplished and then look ahead to this year. As I said, our policy is based on the principle of work. That's why we ask each parent who signs up for assistance to also sign what we call a social contract. Currently, this social contract is a voluntary commitment on the part of welfare recipients to go to work, attend a training program, or be a volunteer at least 20 hours a week in exchange for their benefits. If a family is in need, we'll help, but they have an obligation to help themselves right away, not after a year or two. To encourage the work option, we've removed significant barriers that penalized work. How? Through waivers. Now, parents can stay together in Michigan, work more than 100 hours a month, and keep the first $200 they earn plus 20% of everything else. The result, not surprisingly, more parents are working. An impressive 2 out of 3 parents on welfare are participating in our social contract. And that's voluntarily. Even more impressive is the fact that more than 50,000 parents are working. That's 25% of Michigan's ADC parents working, triple the national average of 8% and the best record in America. The bottom line, instead of increasing grants, we've been increasing opportunities to earn money and to become independent. Instead of paying people not to work, we're making them go to work. To keep families together, we've extended our Families First program. It's a nationally recognized family preservation program to every county in our state. Social workers contracted from private agencies are available on call around the clock, 24 hours. They work intensively with only 2 families at a time and keep them together. Of the 7,500 families that have been helped by the program, 80% are still together a year later. So in Michigan, foster care cases have fallen by nearly 10%, saving taxpayers more than $80 million. That's in sharp contrast to other states where caseloads continue to rise. There's even more good news for Michigan's children. Over the past 2 years, total adoptions have climbed by almost 50%, and adoptions of African American children have more than doubled. These programmatic changes, as well as significant administrative reforms, have made Michigan a national model for welfare reform. Now let's talk about what's next. We're going to improve our successful social contract by making participation mandatory. After 1 year, recipients who have failed to comply will face a 25% reduction in their ADC grant and food stamps. After the 2nd year, ADC grants will be stopped completely for clients who refuse to be working, in training, or volunteering. While our success with the current voluntary program has been impressive, I think it's essential that welfare recipients take responsibility for their own lives. The failure to do so is unfair to their kids and unacceptable to taxpayers. Some argue that any mandatory work requirement is mean-spirited and lacking compassion. I believe what is lacking in compassion is a welfare system that traps families in poverty with no way out. Our proposals give families a way out and a way up. Listen to the story of a woman named Kathy Green. Kathy and her family had been on welfare for several years when she started going to school in 1992. On a typical day, this remarkable woman, she helped her 6 children off to childcare or to school. then attended high school for the rest of the morning. Then she drove 27 miles to a job training program for the rest of the day. At 5:30, she made the 27-mile trip back home to take care of her kids, to do her homework and her housework. Well, she graduated from high school, the job training program, with perfect attendance. Now she's working in off welfare. Her example is inspirational. As she puts it, if I can do it, anyone can. Maybe hearing about me will help someone else. I'm certain it will. But you know what? Those who will really be helped the most are her children. Because unfortunately, the children of single parents on welfare are much more likely to end up in trouble, out of school, out of work, and out of hope. And that's the urgency of welfare reform, to break the cycle of dependency and give more kids a chance. Kathy Green's story makes the point that work leads to independence. And when parents have the courage to make that decision to enter the workforce, our policies ought to reinforce that decision. To do this, we're asking the Clinton administration for waivers to help make work pay even more. The president's often talked about the importance of the earned income tax credit. Well, I agree. That's why we want to advance that credit each month to welfare recipients who are working. Currently, this credit isn't available to most low-income working families until they file their taxes, if they file, in the following year. With monthly advance payments, welfare families get the money when they need it most, as much as $165 each month to pay bills and make ends meet. They get something else too, another incentive to keep working and get off welfare. As a further incentive to keep welfare families working and to allow them to manage more of their money, we also propose cashing out their food stamps each month. Both of these measures are powerful incentives that will give a helping hand to those who have taken that first step back into the workforce. Because for parents trying to break the cycle of welfare dependency, every day on the job brings them that much closer, another day closer, to that independence, to that goal. Under my plan, every working family in Michigan will be above the poverty line because of these changes. Now, my third proposal to make work pay recognizes the fact that some parents who work return to welfare for one simple reason, health care benefits, especially for their children. Current policy allows a family to leave welfare for work and retain coverage for 1 year. We're asking for a waiver so that we can offer these working families or their employers the opportunity after 1 year to buy into our successful Medicaid managed care program. As an aside, I'd note by the end of 1994, Michigan will enroll approximately 1 million Medicaid recipients in managed care. And in contrast to national trends, our Medicaid costs rose only 7% a year. Important statistic, I'll leave that one for Congressman Gephardt, who will be here tomorrow. This ability to have a managed care program like this, and then the ability to buy in to Medicaid, complements another initiative, our Healthy Kids initiative. Starting this spring, Healthy Kids will provide health care coverage to all 80,000 Michigan children living at or below 150% of the poverty line. Finally, we also want to extend the Medicaid buy-in to certain parents who must purchase health care coverage in order to comply with child support orders. In fact, tough enforcement to ensure compliance with child support obligations is a very high priority in Michigan. We want our state to be the toughest in the nation. We have a good system, one of the best support systems in the nation, but we are making it better. But one thing that's very difficult for us is to go after deadbeat parents in other states. Differing laws and jurisdictions and uncooperative out-of-state employers make interstate enforcement complicated, expensive, and often ineffective. Again, the President said he's willing to use federal agencies to dramatically enhance child support enforcement. We accept his offer. So we are asking the administration to make Michigan a pilot state in which the IRS would take over these difficult interstate cases. We all know how tough they can be on a taxpayer who owes $500. Let's see how tough they can be on a deadbeat that owes $5,000 in child support. There's something else, though, too. Being a parent is serious business. It's time to get serious about demanding that all parents shoulder their fair share of the responsibility. No longer in Michigan will a 16-year-old boy be able to father a child and walk away from his responsibility. We will seek to identify every father and expect him to support the child he helped create for 18 years. If they don't, school-age fathers won't be on the football team, the debate team, or any school team for that matter. They'll be working after school, or they're going to be a volunteer in the community. Michigan's policy will be simple, tough, and to the point. If you don't pay, you won't play. Our policy for older dads is just as straightforward. If you don't work and can't pay, you volunteer and make a difference. If the state is putting families first, it's not too much to ask of fathers of all ages to put their families first. Now, having said that, I know that the best possible outcome would be for kids not to have kids in the first place. In Michigan, when a teen girl has a baby, 70% of the time she is unmarried. The situation is even more tragic in Detroit, where that figure rises to 95%. Same statistic, interesting enough, that's true here in the District of Columbia. A disproportionate number of these babies are low birth weight, resulting in higher infant mortality, higher medical costs, and even more burdensome long-term social costs. Michigan statistics are particularly grim on this point. They indicate that 80% of these babies and their mothers will end up on public assistance at some point before the child's fifth birthday. This tells me that the end of welfare as we know it cannot be fully achieved until we end the rising tide of illegitimacy. A government cannot tackle this problem alone. The reason is pretty simple. Government cannot replace the family. There is no substitute for family. Given the scope of the problem, it's awfully easy to be discouraged today. The story in the papers this morning about the Chicago situation that was encountered last night by the police. Some just say, well, that's the way things are in today's society. But I think that's the attitude that we have to change. That's the attitude we have to fight. And solving the problem is going to take leadership from parents and pastors, principals, government and community organizations, and yes, even from the news media. I have faith that there is courage, and there is certainly the compassion in this nation, whether it's between parent and child, pastor and congregation, principals and students, to take this issue on. It's about time that our movies and television build up the family rather than tearing it down. All of America's institutions need to support families, not undermine them. I was pleased yesterday to note that in Congress there's an effort being made to change tax policy that it supports families, not undermines them. And we can go right through every institution in society. But if we're going to answer this call, and these institutions of ours in this country answer this call, if we can stop kids from having kids, if we can make sure that every child learns the difference between right and wrong, we might not bring back Ward and June Cleaver or Ozzie and Harriet, but there's something we will do. We'll strengthen our families. We'll strengthen America. I began this speech by saying that Michigan's welfare reforms are based on work. That's the whole theme that runs through the document we've distributed today. I believe that any kind of work in the private sector is better than being trapped on welfare. However, some are preoccupied with the question of what work is available for welfare recipients. Their concerns can lead to the wrong answer: make work government jobs. The right answer is twofold: a healthy economy that's creating private sector jobs, and a network of schools and training programs that prepare people to get and hold those jobs. In Michigan, we're creating the jobs. In fact, our economy has added more than 300,000 jobs since August of 1991, 125,000 jobs last year alone. U.S. News and World Report ranked Michigan's economic recovery the best among the large industrial states. The Wall Street Journal said our economy is one of the fastest growing in the country. And the bond buyer put it best with their headline, Michigan is back. To help people learn the skills they need to go to work, we've done something that's cutting edge. We've restructured and reorganized job training in Michigan to eliminate the maze of different and confusing programs. Unfortunately, we haven't completely curbed Washington's insatiable appetite to keep on adding to the confusion. At last count, there were 145 federal job training programs. Now, Secretary Rice told the governors this week, and I applaud his commitment, that his goal was to restructure and streamline those programs. He will have the support of the nation's governors to get that task accomplished as well. It can be done. In Michigan, we consolidated more than $400 million in job training funds under one roof at our Michigan Jobs team. And through their account management structure, we're linking the employers who have the jobs with the workers who want jobs. We're also getting a lot more for our money by competitively bidding the job training programs out. And we bid on a basis of both cost and quality, and we've expanded the number of both public and private contractors that are eligible to bid to provide that training. And just as importantly, we're monitoring local job markets, interviewing employers, finding out exactly what they need. Then we require the training to be done with those specific needs in mind. Not training for training's sake, but training to get somebody on the job. When you look at the total picture, Michigan's welfare to work training program is now the largest in the nation. But again, we want to do more. In Bay County, for example, we're experimenting with welfare grant diversion. In this program, for 6 months, all or part of a welfare recipient's check is diverted to an employer who agrees to hire and train that person. For example, we had a local manufacturer hired a third-generation welfare recipient to be a janitor. After a rocky start, he got his act together. He was promoted to a crew leader, foreman, and ultimately currently a shift supervisor. It's clearly a win-win-win proposition. Former welfare clients win because they get a training and they get a job. Employers win because they get the help they need. And taxpayers win because the program doesn't cost any more money in the short run and saves a lot of money in the long run. That's why we're seeking to expand this program. Consider the potential. More than $1.25 billion is spent on ADC in Michigan. Just a small percentage of that amount is diverted to help employers hire and train recipients. We can help thousands more people make the transition again from welfare to work. And there's another way to accomplish this goal. It's simple, effective, and doesn't cost a dime. We've learned that many parents on welfare never went to work because nobody ever asked them or told them they had to go. As example, there's Lance Downer, a former welfare recipient, who 3 years ago, after I took that action that was mentioned by Gil, eliminating general assistance for single able-bodied adults, signed a petition to recall me. Well, the recall didn't work, but today Lance is. He's working as a banker, my favorite donut shop. You might note I'm a regular customer there. You can probably tell that. But 2 weeks ago, I stopped by. He presented me with a special donut that he'd made. Written on the top in pink icing, it said, 4 more years. And he said, you can count on my support. And his story, and there are thousands more, I think, that could tell similar stories, because there are men and women out there just like Lance. People who thought they just couldn't make it in the workforce. But with a little encouragement and a helping hand, they're getting their lives together. So far today, all of the reforms I've talked about address the question, how do we help families get off of welfare? Well, a more important question is, how do we keep families from getting on welfare in the first place? The key there is improving our public schools by teaching our kids basic skills, by not giving diplomas to kids who can't read them, by making sure our graduates can fill the jobs of the 21st century. Last year, Michigan did make national news when we scrapped the property tax system and promised to reform our schools. Gil, we finished on December 24th, Christmas Eve, after a 28-hour marathon session. And the result was that we changed forever the way we pay for our schools. We made the system more fair by reducing dramatic financial inequities among school districts and by increasing opportunities for every student. Perhaps most important, aside from the tax changes, on the policy side, fundamental reform, because we enacted the nation's most far-reaching charter school legislation. With charter schools, I predict nothing less than a renaissance of public education in my state. More than 600 entities, every school district, there's 558 of them, every intermediate school district, there's 57 of them, our community colleges and our universities are authorized to grant charters to establish public schools. This is fundamental and radical change that will create unlimited competition in public education. For the first time in America, the public school monopoly has been broken, competition is a reality, and parents and students have choices. Charter schools will be a powerful force for change that's going to help improve the quality of every public school in our state, that will provide new education opportunities for every child in our state. There's no question about it, the charter school legislation in Michigan, which is unlimited in its scope, will provide brand new opportunities. I want to conclude my remarks just with an observation about the national reform debate. The success of welfare reform cannot be measured in the number of new programs or dollars spent. Success must be measured one worker, one parent, and one family at a time as they find jobs, grow stronger, and reach independence. Families, and brought along, Dick Ryan will appreciate this, Detroit News. It's also the JOA, though, because of the paper, so it's the Free Press, too. But families like Jennifer and Steve Yale of Flint, and their two kids, 3-year-old Matthew and baby Jessica. Last year, we told them to get a job or to go to school. This is Jennifer's quote. It made us realize they couldn't, meaning the state, take care of us the rest of our lives. It made us wake up faster to get a job and better ourselves. It is time for Washington to wake up and for Washington to realize the best way to reform welfare is the Michigan way, the Wisconsin way, the Delaware way, the Massachusetts way, any way the states decide. Senator Bob Dole summed it up best when he told the nation's governors, and I quote, "We need to give the states flexibility. The states are light years ahead of the federal bureaucracy. Our top priority must be to stay out of your way." That's good advice. Congress should heed it. Get out of the way, stay out of the way. I'm very proud that Michigan is leading the way. We're making people take responsibility for their lives. We're requiring parents to support their children. We're keeping families together and strong. And we're helping families go to work. In Michigan, welfare reform is working. Thank you very much for your attention today.
Well, I've been waiting for the angels here to come down. I don't see the angels coming down with the welfare plan and the health plan, so I guess you guys are going to have to do it yourselves or in Congress. So the first question has to be a political one. Ohio Governor Voinovich suggested at the Republican governor's meeting Monday with the House and Senate GOP leadership that their state welfare directors meet with their staff to write a unity GOP reform plan. Will there be a GOP consensus?
Well, I hope so. That really specifically dealt with the health care issue, but it is applicable as well to welfare reform, where there are considerable efforts being made in both the House and Senate caucuses. Representative Camp, who I mentioned earlier, was part of an effort with Congressman Santorum and others in the Republican caucus in the House, and they've achieved rather unique sponsorship, virtually 160-plus members of their caucus. All in support of one measure. So there is an effort to bring everybody together. I think the important point on welfare reform is this, for the president, is that he will have to fight for it. It won't be easy. And I think that the Republicans become natural allies. And there are a good deal of consensus points that exist between the administration, between the nation's governors, Democrat and Republican governors alike, and Republican members of Congress. I think it'll be the left side of the Congress that, in the president's party, that'll have the difficulty. The DLC membership should be just fine. And one of the temptations, and I know Republicans struggle with this, being in the minority in the Congress, being in the minority in Washington, do we sit back and let the president try to do this, or do we play a role? I think this has to be something like NAFTA. I do think the nation's interest argues for urgent attention to welfare reform. I think that the answer is to let the states do it. I don't think that we can build the consensus on Capitol Hill that will give us the kind of flexibility and reform that we need. I think if there's a state that wants to have a full-blown CETA types jobs program, let them do it. That won't be Michigan's choice. If there's a state that wants to implement what Bill Bennett wrote about in this week in a column about ending public assistance completely for unmarried women, then a state should be free to do that, or take Charles Murray's vision and implement that. I think that kind of experimentation at the state level ought to be authorized, and I feel very strongly about that, and I think that is something that there is a basis for consensus with a center of the Congress. I think that the Waxman wing of the Democratic Party will not be part of that solution.
What was the genesis of Michigan's welfare plan? Did you follow any models, and if so, which ones?
Well, I think that, we followed common sense. It was a real radical model out there. Director Jerry Miller, who's just done a superb job as the director of our Department of Social Services and has motivated the staff over there to really look anew, and I and a number of others sat down and said, what are we going to do? The system is broken beyond repair. What can we change, and how quickly can we bring about those changes? And we went back to basics. And work is a basic. The ethic of work has to be instilled in everyone. Kids have to grow up in families where they see a parent working. The idea that in America we've tolerated a system which allows someone to be paid a check simply to sit at home and do nothing is wrong. And that's what we're changing. And so we're saying, from day one, when someone comes and says, I need help, we'll help, but you have to be willing to help yourself. And that's what our principles are. And I mean, they're a pretty old-fashioned set of values, I guess, that are embodied in the changes we've made. We don't think they're that radical. We think they are common sense, and sometimes that is uncommon.
What kinds of jobs are these parents on the social contract doing? If many are volunteering in churches or daycare, are they really learning skills that can translate into real jobs?
That's a good question, and I wanted to, that's why I touched on that a little bit in the remarks. But first of all, the thing we're proud of is that 50,000 number that are actually working. And they're working in the private sector, and they're doing lots of things. This jobs debate's gotten a little bit off kilter, I think, because there's almost an assumption, well, we're talking about some kind of middle management job that's going to be available for someone moving from public assistance into the workforce. And we're really talking about any number of jobs, many of which are at or slightly above minimum wage, but represent the first step on the ladder. Very few in this room had the first job at the top of the company or the business or whatever. And I think that what we're talking about is working one's way up, but establishing the ethic of work is of paramount importance. A lot of these are jobs that don't pay a lot. But, you know, it doesn't take a lot to earn more than one is earning on public assistance. And that's also something that's lost sight of. It's not that one gets rich on welfare with welfare payments at any of the states in the nation. And so we're talking about, and the change that we made, I touched on it, but I want to highlight it, where we dealt with the earnings. And we said the first $200 that one earns, one keeps. That was a very basic change because we put an incentive back. We removed a barrier under the old income disregard system, which was very complicated to administer. You went to work, within 2 months you were being penalized. Now we're saying to someone, get started, get that work experience, and start building. On the child care front, we've got a great demand for even more child care providers to be out there. They do need trained workers. There are some opportunities. There are opportunities, and we've seen some of our clients actually get into a position where we hope they'll be owning and running child care businesses in the future. And on the volunteer side, We've actually had volunteers working in our Department of Social Services offices, and their volunteer responsibility was to call other recipients to make sure they were fulfilling their voluntary responsibilities or that they were working. But when you've got 25% working and the national average is 8, that is a statistically important difference.
What will happen to people who don't comply with the mandatory plan and have all those general assistance recipients you kicked off the rolls found jobs?
We think many of them have. We've seen some interesting data there, too. Not some 35% of the general assistance population never even came back for food stamps, which was kind of an interesting bit of data that we've looked at to try to understand were all the people really there in the first place. It's not really clear. A good number of them have found jobs. We've done other things to make sure that if there were problems, they were dealt with. For instance, one thing that's worked extraordinarily well in Michigan is a contract that we have with the Salvation Army to deal with the problem of homelessness. Instead of us trying to run the shelters, we merely have a contract with the Army. We now have a 1-800 number in the state, and our law enforcement agencies, anybody that's in the media, any citizen, we run public service announcements, say, look, if you see somebody who's in trouble, call this number, 1-800-A-SHELTER, and we'll come and deal with the problem. So we've dealt with that. What kind of jobs and what happens if we go 2 years? We think that the percentage of compliance is going to be very, very high. We're already getting, under a voluntary system, very high compliance. And one of the things that sometimes happens in these reform debates is that the opponents of reform wish to pose all kinds of questions that can't be answered before the reforms are undertaken. And so the perfect becomes the enemy of the better. And in this case, we're clearly convinced that the reforms we're advocating are better than the system that we've had, and that we should undertake that and go forward. We will see what happens. But we think we will have significant compliance. And to the extent that we don't, then we will deal with that at that point in the future. But it is not a reason that we should not go forward. The idea that someone can pose a question that can't be answered until we undertake the reforms shouldn't disqualify us from attempting the reforms.
This question following up on that says, there are some reports that say 60% of the general assistance clients you eliminated from the welfare rolls were over 40 years of age or mentally ill or disabled. Of course, that, of course, assumes that anybody over 40 years old is disabled, I guess, and you and I are in trouble.
Yeah, we're in trouble.
Can you explain what has happened to these people?
Well, we've done follow-up studies. I mean, we've seen some headline stories that have been generated that where they've gone out and found one or two and said, well, this is what happened, this was tragic. But, I mean, there are other people. I use the example of Lance. I don't think he was a general assistance recipient, but we've got a number of others who've gone back to work. A lot of this is anecdotal. It's hard to track these people, but we have ample evidence that many, many of those recipients have found jobs part-time. Now, remember, the general assistance they lost, this is how they were living, was as these were single adults, and they were living or purportedly living on roughly payments of $150 to $160 a month. I mean, that's a program in 35 other states didn't even exist at the time Michigan eliminated the general assistance program. That was done in 1991. The other thing that's part of that story that often isn't told is at the time we made that decision, we were able to maintain a strong safety net underneath the ADC families with women and children. And we simply made it a priority decision. Do we put resources behind families with children, or do we put it behind single able-bodied adults? And we chose the families with the children.
Some say your proposal to cut welfare payments by $25 for those who fail to vaccinate their children is typical of your, quote, punitive, quote, unquote, approach to public policy. What is your response?
Okay. Well, I said some would suggest that any mandatory provisions are punitive and lacking compassion. I think that, the statistics are overwhelming. We ought to have kids vaccinated in Michigan. We provide free vaccinations. We actually produce, we're one of two states, Massachusetts being the other, that actually produces the vaccines. And so there is no problem. It is a distribution issue, and we have literally some parental irresponsibility where we're not taking the children to get the free shot. We're trying to make it easier even than today's process to get those shots delivered. But It has been interesting to watch the experiment in Wisconsin, which was described in very similar terms. I've heard Governor Thompson talk about the success. They passed a requirement dealing with school attendance and did the same thing. They said, if kids are not in school, we're going to penalize. Guess what? More kids are in school. There is a cause and effect sometimes, and we think that there's nothing more important, certainly, than taking care of health care needs of these young children, because that can lead to serious problems later on. It can be a barrier. They can't go to school without having the immunizations done, so we think it's the right way to go. And I think, again, taxpayers have some expectation that if they're willing to help and to show compassion in helping, that the recipients of that help then in turn will accept some responsibility that's fairly basic, that's accepted in most American families, and certainly vaccination of one's children is such a responsibility.
This questioner wants to know, how much will healthy kids cost and how will you pay for it?
We're paying for healthy kids by using some of the savings that we've achieved by reducing our foster care caseloads, by reducing actual caseloads in ADC, we've seen those trending down, by reducing the actual cost per case, because as people earn money, they reduce the total cost of their case, and so we're taking some of those savings and diverting, and our estimate is in the $40 to $50 million range on Healthy Kids Initiative. It's not cheap to do that, but it clearly allows us then to help build that bridge, because if someone goes to work, I mentioned that concern, oftentimes there's almost a fear that one's got to return to welfare in order to gain health care coverage. By dealing with the kids, we've dealt with the priority, and we think by taking care of 80,000 children up to 150% of poverty, we've made it that much easier for someone who's trying to get off of welfare to stay off once off, or for someone who's not on the system to avoid falling into welfare. It works both ways.
This questioner, referring to your buddy Lance at the donut shop, he said, at what point does the donut shop have to pay Lance's salary, not the state of Michigan?
They're paying it all right now. Lance is not a beneficiary of any state program at the moment. He is paid by, he's an employee full-time of the donut shop.
Is that a problem, though, of the state paying?
I can elaborate on that. We, obviously, what we do is we say that if someone's on ADC, they go to work, the first $200 they earn, they keep. They earn, then above that, 20% of everything else, so $1.05, there would come a point at which one would phase out over time. Under current federal law and under Michigan policy, we then pay those health care benefits for a full year. We're suggesting that in order to make sure that continues to work then in a second year and a third year, we use this waiver to allow Medicaid buy-in. It just is over time. That would differ in every state, interestingly enough, because different states have different benefit levels. But assuming states had the same policy as Michigan, they, like our state, would phase out over a period of time. But we really think that this kind of an approach has done an awful lot to expose people. And we found that some people we literally have had clients, and I put this in, it's almost unbelievable. I run into people and say, well, that can't be true. We have clients who say, I've never been asked to go to work. We didn't used to ask in our Department of Social Services. We never asked them to go to work. If they qualified, we paid them the benefits and sent them the checks. We checked every so often to see if they still qualified, met the test. But we didn't ask them to go to work. We didn't tell them they had to. That was the way it used to be. Now it's not the way it is today, but it was surprising. We found people out there saying, well, I'm glad somebody cares. I mean, it was really remarkable.
Should there be a two-year limit to welfare no matter what? Is that too arbitrary?
Well, our national governor's policy, adopted by Democrat and Republican governors alike, calls for time-limited benefits. And I think that states ought to be free to adopt a two-year absolute limit. Now, that wouldn't mean a complete limit because of existing federal policy, and one of the concerns in the debate is how much flexibility will the states be given. For instance, at the end of 2 years, one would still draw food stamps. Even under the proposal I've made under existing federal law, you would still have food stamps if you weren't drawing any cash benefit from the state. Some say, well, what about the children in that situation? Of course, one of the things that happens if I know that in 2 years there's a cutoff point, I'm going to be working pretty hard in the training program to make sure that there is something out there for me. So it's a, yeah, I think states ought to have that flexibility to draw an absolute deadline. And that's really what this federalism system of ours is all about, to let different states approach these questions in different ways. And I think sometimes the Congress gets so wrapped up in trying to create a one-size-fits-all profile of these major systems that they miss quite badly. If they were interested in equity, obviously one of the things that they would have done long ago is rewrite the different funding and matching formulas, which are very different from region of region to the, or state to state across America. And yet they've not done that because that happens to benefit financially one region at the expense of the other, or one state at the expense of another. So there is at least some limitation to the moral concern that we've seen up on the Hill, given the way they've written these formulas. So they ought to allow for the flexibility on the policy side, since they've mandated distinctions on the funding side.
In the last few minutes here, I'd like to get over to this education question, because that's why I asked you to come. Tell me, where will the money come from for education now that you've eliminated the property taxes? What is the status of that now, and do you have any regrets of doing something so radical so quickly?
Well, I have no regrets, because I'll tell you, without the dramatic change of literally eliminating $7 billion worth of property taxes in August of this year, or of 93, we would not have been able to bring all of the parties to the table to deal with the issues of education equity and education reform. There's nothing like putting $10 billion on the table to concentrate the minds about the issue at hand, and that's exactly what happened in Michigan. And in fact, we've come up with a system which still does retain some property taxes. In the end, we did restore some property taxes. There will be a 6-mil levy statewide on all property, and then there is an additional levy on non-homestead property. But then that will be supplemented by a sales tax increase, which will be voted on March 15th. That's an important election coming up in our state, because people are choosing between 6 cents on sales versus a 6% flat rate income tax, which would be the highest in the nation, which is something that I very much don't want to see. The legislative compromise on the finance side came down to this, that the ballot plan that I favored using the sales tax required a two-thirds vote in order to get that through the legislature. There was a requirement to have a backup plan to satisfy those who said, well, what if the sales tax is defeated? What do you do next? And so the backup plan is an income tax, which I don't think will ever come to pass, because I think the public support seems to continue to be growing for the sales tax, partially on the belief that as you travel to Michigan from various states, you should pay for our schools and services just like we pay when we go to your states. And so many of the neighboring states, and certainly Canada on Michigan's border, have much higher sales taxes. Even at 6 cents, our sales tax would be below the Great Lakes region. The on the reform side, what happened that really was significant is that we were able to sort of, I guess to use a Washington phrase, changed the paradigm. I mean, we really did throw out the old and brought in the new, and the new makes every school district in the state financially responsible for all of their costs. It requires that every school district really focus on performance and accountability by allowing the money to follow the child, and sets up a system where there'll be almost open competition for students, and it'll work much more like our higher education and community college system works today, where parents and students have some choices. And the charter public schools, I'm optimistic, will now allow the Edison Project, for instance, to get off the ground. I've talked to Dr. Schmidt. I think that there's going to be an opportunity now for them to come to Michigan and to operate schools under the financing structure that we've created. Allowing the universities to charter schools is somewhat innovative, and as we looked around the country, we saw state after state that have talked about this, and they ended up only having authority to create 6 schools or 10 schools per year. We have no limit. You will see quality school districts create a charter school that runs concurrent with their school year in an effort to top off their student bodies. In other words, if they've got excess capacity, it's worth money to bring those students into those empty chairs, and that'll put pressure on the school district that's losing students to get better in order to stop losing students. So it's going to be an interesting situation. It will require a much more entrepreneurial outlook on the part of school leadership. I think the school boards now, having been freed from the burden of almost annually fighting for increased millages, can become school quality committees rather than school millage committees. It is an interesting period that we're embarking upon, and at the end of February we'll have a statewide charter schools conference to really introduce all of the details of this legislation to those who might be interested. And we've already had to change locations because the preliminary indications of demand and interest in the conference are so great that we did not have room in the facility. So watch Michigan. I think this is going to lead to very rapid change. I've felt for some time that it's very hard to change public education from the top down, that it really had to come from the bottom up, that it had to challenge teachers and innovative educators to do their best, and it had to be a system that rewards excellence. And public education today doesn't reward excellence, nor does it have consequences for subpar performance. And our system will now have consequences and rewards.
I should have allowed more time for the education section. That sounds very interesting. But we are about out of time. Before asking the last question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for appearing here today and a National Press Club mug,
right,
something that every
much.
Governor needs.
Absolutely.
And the last question is, I'm still fascinated with this idea that you wrote this term paper. What possessed an agriculture student to write a term paper about how to defeat incumbents? And what did your agriculture teacher say when he got this term paper?
Well, fortunately, I attended one of the finest universities in the United States, Michigan State University, and they believe in a broad education for even agricultural economics students, so I was over taking a class in political science. The motivation for writing the paper had to do with my father, who 2 years prior had run for the office of state representative and been defeated. And I had worked on my first campaign for about 3 weeks and found it to be completely disorganized and quite chaotic. But I knew very little about it, and so I went back to take a look at it. And this course happened to provide an opportunity to write a paper, which was actually written for somebody else. This person declined to run, and so my collaborator and I decided that we would put it into a test, and that it worked so well that we were able to win by 162 votes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Just a reminder that transcripts are available by calling 1-800-500-9900.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.